What can you learn about a friend, a colleague, or lover by looking at their everyday objects and how they're arranged? A lot, as it turns out, perhaps even more than an intimate conversation would reveal. Joining me now for a look at the art of snooping on this week's Please Explain are Sam Gosling, professor of psychology at the University of Texas at Austin and author of a new book called Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. It's published by Basic Books. And Daniel R. Ames, professor at Columbia Business School. And I'm very pleased to welcome them to the show. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Sam, wasn't your research into how we project our inner selves featured in Malcolm Gladwell's Blink?
Yeah, it was. He was looking at one of the studies where we looked at people's personal living spaces and what you can pick up by snooping around those places.
And how did you become interested in that subject?
I came interested in it, I think it was something we all do. I was just interested in looking at how people express themselves in different ways. And I think we all do it naturally. We're always, when somebody, we go into somebody's house, we cast our eye around. And this was just saying, well, are we really picking something up? We certainly think we're picking something up, but is there something there?
Well, we've always judged people, I guess, as you say, intuitively. But when did this become a matter of scientific research?
Oh, very recently. People haven't really been looking at how personalities are expressed in everyday life until the past, say, 10 or 15 years, but now they're beginning to do so.
Daniel, what does your research focus on?
I focus mostly on impression formation, some of the same kinds of things that Sam looks at, how people make good first impressions, bad first impressions, what we go on when we form a first impression.
Are some people more gifted snoopers than others?
I think some people are good hypothesis testers, and so they're able to look for evidence that sort of confirms or denies a particular hypothesis.
Because the opposite has happened with me. I've often realized after a disastrous relationship ended, I knew all of this when I first met this person, but then I developed very, very convenient amnesia. Mm-hmm. But I knew it. I sense it from the start. But there are people who do this professionally, aren't there? Like FBI profilers.
I think that's right. I think they're used to assembling different pieces of data and trying to form an overall picture of somebody.
Right, and they're looking for criminal behavior, of course. So mm-hmm. What we're interested in is ordinary, everyday behavior.
Well, what are identity claims?
Well, identity claims, these are deliberate statements we make to others and to ourselves about what we're like. So this is really important. And I think what's interesting is it's something we don't really think about. We just think, hey, yeah, I really like this picture of me sitting on top of a train and, you know, that sends the mountains in Nepal or something. We don't think about it. We just think that's cool. But really what we are doing is we are broadcasting a message to people. And that's important. You can learn something about someone, about what message they choose to tell others.
So the pictures we put up as opposed to the ones that we just keep in a drawer are important. But then there are the other things. Some people tell us a lot by the way they dress, mm-hmm. by whether they have tattoos, whether they have pins in their noses, all sorts of other
things. The way they shake your hands, yeah, mm-hmm. what their cars look like, music collections. That's the point, is that personality is expressed in just about everything we do. The trick is trying to distill the useful information.
Well, how mm-hmm. much of this is done unconsciously and how much of it is done to tell people about ourselves?
In terms of the messages and signals that we send, I think some of it's done consciously and deliberately, like Sam shows in the book, but some of it kind of leaks out. I think that's one of the provocative things Sam reveals in the book, is that we leave a behavioral residue, sometimes despite our intentions, that there are clues that people could pick up on that tell them something about who we are, even if we don't acknowledge that about ourselves or we don't want them to pick that up.
Well, can't we fake an impression like cleaning up a messy house before people come to visit?
I think it's harder to do than you imagine, and that's something we discovered. We thought when we went, everyone would tidy up their living spaces before we went in, but one of the things we discovered is there's really quite an important difference between what you might call a tidy room, a deeply tidy space, and a tidied space, because there's only so much you can do to tidy a space, even because you have to live that life. You can't just tidy up the paper clips. You have to have the paper clip holder. You have mm-hmm. to, and you have to see the world in that way. I like to think about my office. I sometimes try and tidy my office, but I just don't notice that the books aren't alphabetized or, mm-hmm. you know, the cables aren't coiled up. And I don't see it. Whereas my colleague next door, she perceives the world differently. And she wouldn't even be able to get any work done if you know, one of the journals was in slightly the wrong place or something.
We're talking on today's Please Explain About What Your Stuff Says About You with Sam Gosling, who's written a book called Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You on Basic Books, and also Daniel R. Ames, who's a professor at Columbia Business School. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, can't snooping sometimes be misleading? For example, you might assume that a copy of Virginia Woolf novel in sitting on the table would suggest that the woman you're talking with is a feminist, but she may just have it because she had to read it for a college course.
Mm-hmm. That's right. What I see is, and any single clue is very, very hard to interpret, and so that's what why I put what I call the Belgian solution, which is really about, which is following Hercule Poirot's idea of saying we have to build a case piece by piece. Any single clue could easily be misleading. And there are certain ways that you would want to build up that case. So is the Virginia Woolf book, is that put prominently in a public place for others to see? You know, does it match the theme of the books in the private places? And there, if you saw a discrepancy between what's in public and private, then that would give you some hints that what's really going on is the person's trying to project a good impression.
Well, Daniel, what are the complex mental processes that go on when people meet?
When they form impressions of others?
Yeah.
Our research suggests one of the things that's a really essential part of first impressions is trying to figure out what somebody thinks about themselves and also what they think about you. So do they have self-confidence? Are they potentially arrogant? Do they think they're better than you? Or are they actually interested in and engaged in you?
Is this something that, is there an evolutionary aspect to this? Is this because we do so much of it unconsciously? Do you think that cavemen met each other and said, boy, what a messy club he has.
I think there is an evolution. I mean, if right now, the part of the world that affords us the most dangers and the most opportunities are other people. So we're highly attuned to what other people are like. And I think that's why we try and pick up on any available piece of information. So I do think that not only did the, you know, cavemen and cavewomen do that, but probably many animals do too. It's very important to know what your conspecifics are like.
You list five traits that are most easily determined by snooping.
Mm-hmm.
What are they?
There are a number of traits. Yes. The first one is what you might call extroversion. This is people who are outgoing, gregarious, enthusiastic, energetic. These are the people you want to start at a party. They like parties, whereas opposed to introverts, the thought of a party that fills them with fear. Then there's the next trait is what I call the Mr. Rogers factor. These are people who are nice, sympathetic, kind, versus people who'll tell you how it is and aren't worried about hurting your feelings and so on. The next trait is what I call conscientiousness, which is, I call it the sort of the Robocop factor. These people they get stuff done on time. These are the people you want sitting in the air traffic control towers. They are there. They don't forget about the plane coming in from Karachi. They are on the ball. They show up to work on time. These are responsible, good people.
And we spot these things immediately?
Some of the things we do. And that's one of the interesting things is that you can't, for example, people don't spot conscientiousness, this air traffic control factor, by looking at their music collection, but they do about snooping around their bedroom. So what can you learn? You know, what can you learn about people? Well, it depends where you're looking, where you get that information from.
We've done three.
The next dimension is neuroticism. So this, you could think of the sort of the Woody Allen factor versus the dude. These are people who are uptight and anxious and easily stressed out versus people who are laid back and calm and aren't bothered by stuff. And then the final factor is the Leonardo factor, which is people who are broad-minded and intellectual, deep thinkers versus people who are more conventional, concrete, and so on.
And I wondered why they named me Leonardo. do the Big Five offer greater insights than personality tests like the Myers-Briggs?
I think they do in some ways because they provide there's much more science behind it. So really, the Myers-Briggs is tremendously popular, and I'm sure there are some insights into it.
But we're choosing to what we want to reveal about ourselves there. You're saying that these other things are things that we don't always understand that we're revealing about ourselves.
Right, yeah. So I guess the thing about personality questionnaires, like the Myers-Briggs, is we are making a statement, but we're often deluded and about ourselves. For example, if I wanted to know, you know, if you are anxious, I should probably ask you, because you're the one who knows that you're worried and I don't see that. But if I want to know, are you stingy, I shouldn't ask you. I should ask your friends, because they're the ones that get stuck with the check at the end of the night.
Well, Daniel, what about stereotypes like that? Can stereotypes be useful when you're snooping?
Sure. I think Sam outlines this in the book some, that stereotypes we have related to gender or race sometimes have some elements of accuracy in them. Of course, they can lead to prejudice, they can be destructive, but sometimes they lead to effective inferences.
Because stereotypes also are understood by the person who is being stereotyped. We self-identify with a group sometimes and actually live by certain stereotypes because of that self-identification.
And some identity claims almost invite social categorization and invite others to judge us on the basis of certain group memberships.
You say certain elements of personality just leak or seep out. What do you mean by leak?
Despite our intentions, we might want to sort of disguise something. Some things about our character or our attitudes kind of come out. One thing that I've been studying lately with my research team is listening. And listening behavior is not something that people can really tell us about. We ask people, do you think you're a good listener? You give them a test, something like the Myers-Briggs or the kinds of measures that Sam might use. And you say, tell us, you know, how good do you think you are at listening? And almost everybody says, you know, I'm reasonably good or I'm fantastic. And it's almost that we have to go to the people around them to find out how good are they indeed at listening. It's almost like they can't tell us. So that there's an aspect of their personality that leaks out that in some sense is even unobservable to them.
But I would imagine in some cases you have to determine whether the element is deliberate or whether it's leaked.
Whether it's controllable or whether it's...
Whether I've decided... You know, suddenly somebody told me, you're not a good listener. And so for the next week, I just sit and stare at people as they talk and look totally sympathetic.
The most engaged I ever find my students to be is when I'm talking about listening. So it makes them hyper aware of that topic and their behavior.
What should we look for, Sam, when we're scoping out a colleague's desk, for example?
Mm-hmm. Well, a desk is a great place because there tends to be lots of clues. But the main thing you should look for is consistency. We're looking for patterns here. As you say, you know, you can try and give an impression by tidying up the desk a bit or something like that. But what you really want to look for is these clues that show behavior, because this is where you'll really see behavioral residue. We're there all the time. We're doing something. So if you look at my desk, it's very messy. You'll see there is a calendar there, but the calendar's under a whole bunch of other stuff. It's not used. So it's not enough just to count up the items. You need to look at the state of the items and their placement, because that reveals the psychological function they serve.
So what does that say about you?
It says that I'm not very high on this conscientiousness factor. I didn't tell me that I'll show up late.
I would think that you'd be so self-conscious as a result of doing this for both of you that you'd be laying out all sorts of false cues. I've always wondered about some of the things that appeal to me about myself. I had a photograph of myself in a kilt, and I had another one of me on a horse that I showed prominently in my office. You know, I mean, this is the only time I ever wore a kilt, and I have ridden horses in my life, but I'm not exactly a horseman.
Okay.
I guess I was saying, you know, I could be eccentric.
Yeah. But I think the looking at these sorts
and nobody would have guessed that from knowing me.
No. Well, they may not. I think one of the important things is, and this is really a key element of snooping, is that often these items can lead us in directions that we wouldn't otherwise have gone. So even if we don't know what that kilt and that horse means, we look at it and say, I don't really get it. It would lead us down a line of questioning that we never would have gone otherwise and possibly learn something that we wouldn't know just in our ordinary interactions.
And I'm inviting that inquiry.
Are those photographs facing you when you're sitting at your desk, or are they facing
out,
sort of broadcasting?
They're not facing me. Okay. Although one was, it was put up on the bulletin board in front of me.
That's something interesting, I think, that comes out of the book as well, about these sort of emotion or mood regulators, that some people have possessions and artifacts that are really there for themselves,
right.
And other artifacts are really there to broadcast something to others.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, we invite your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. My guests are Sam Gosling and Daniel R. Ames, and we're talking about what your stuff reveals about you. When we come back, I want to find out what you should look for on a first date. And as I said, take as many calls as we can. The number 212-433-9692. On today's Please Explain, we're talking about Snoopology. What Your Stuff Says About You. Sam Gosling, who is the author of Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You from Basic Books, is here, along with Daniel R. Ames, who is a professor at Columbia Business School. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. And while people are calling in, I just wanted to cover one other area, because this is so important for all of our lives. What should you look for on a first date? Sam, you write that music is a useful conversational topic when you want to know someone better, but everybody knows that already.
They do know that, but they don't know exactly what it is you can learn. And that's one of the important things of this new generation of research, which is going on and saying, what are the traits? So, for example, we think we can learn all kinds of things about somebody from their music collection. It turns out we can only learn some. We think we can learn all kinds of things from the way they shake your hands, but we can only learn some of those things. So some of the things that appear obvious are actually wrong.
Well, nowadays, a lot of people look at the Facebook or MySpace page when they meet somebody. What are the things that they should look for at those sites?
Well, I think one of the things that you can get from those sites is the things people do. But there's some research that suggests we really understand someone best, or at least how they see themselves, when we understand more about how they feel about what they do, the attitudes, the ideas, the beliefs that lie underneath the actual behaviors. So I think, to the extent, whether it's a conversation or a Facebook profile, that you can sort of open the lid and sort of get inside someone's mind, that's going to bring you closer to at least how they see themselves.
Well, what does it say about someone like me that I don't have a Facebook or a MySpace page?
Well, it may
be. Other than I'm old.
Yeah, that's what it says.
Well, how do you know when someone is using their profile to be something they're not? Isn't that always a concern?
It is a concern. Our research shows that, and we wondered this, we did this research. We said, we looked at people's Facebook profiles, for example, and we said, are people projecting themselves as they really see themselves or as they'd like to be? And it turns out, with a couple of exceptions, but by and large, people are projecting the image the way they see themselves. And I think that's a really important point to bear in mind, is that we always think, well, how are people going to pull the wool over our eyes and deceive us? It turns out, and a lot of psychological research has made this point over the past 10 years or so, is that we actually want to be known. We want to be known. We're not trying to fool people.
Let's take some calls. Melanie from Bedford, New York. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Yeah, I'm currently trying to sell our house, and the realtor had told us to kind of put a lot of things away. And the one place that I didn't really put anything away was my office. And it's interesting because I can't imagine them coming into my office. There's a Bruce Lee action figure with a sign that says, "Let peace prevail on earth," right under him. There's a Buddha hanging from right above my laptop. There's just this old kind of 60s genie lamp with beaded peace sign hanging from, you know, and I'm in this kind of area where people are looking for their first home, and they, you know, anyway, it's kind of interesting. I'm kind of looking at my office in a little bit different way.
And you started thinking about it because of this conversation?
Yeah, definitely. This conversation, and just that I kind of wonder sometimes, like, who am I really showing this office to? Is it to me? It's to me as well as my kids and as well as the people that are just coming in to look and to see if they want to buy the house. And I'm wondering if my office sometimes shoos away the people that are a little more conservative. So anyway.
Any thoughts, either of you?
It might well do. I think this whole quandary you're facing, though, demonstrates another really important point, and that is that we tend not to be aware of the audience we're trying to send the messages to. So you had always seen these things as sort of messages for yourself and your family within a certain circle, a certain social circle. And now that is only becoming apparent who the intended audience was. Now you can imagine other people coming in and jumping to all kinds of conclusions about you.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Finish.
Yeah. I mean, I just have little messages on my desk and sea glass and, you know, stones and little lighthouse, and my whole desk is all doodled, and, you know, I've just had a lot of fun in there, and it's just kind of interesting to open it up to the larger world.
Well, so. You're about to begin a negotiation if you're selling this house, and there's a tremendous amount of research suggesting people heading into a negotiation take anything they can get about their negotiation partner, and that factors into their opening move and how they behave during the negotiation, even if it's not a meaningful clue. So you could look at your possessions from the point of view, what do they say about you as a negotiator about to sell a home?
Thank you so much for your call. Karen from Teaneck, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was at my physician's office the other day, and I consciously noticed for the first time that her photos of her children were facing me. And I was curious about this before this show, and I'm even more curious now what she might be trying to convey by having her patients, other visitors, looking at photos of her children rather than having them face her.
Right. Well, this is one of the things I look for when I go into people's offices. Which way are the photos facing? Are they facing the person? Which suggests it's, if they were facing your doctor, then that would suggest it's, these are what you call social snacks. So they're to make her feel better. But no, what these ones are doing is they're identity claims. Now, again, as I said before, these doesn't mean they're disingenuous. It means she wants to communicate her value. So here, it appears she's trying to say, look, I'm just like you. I have a family. I'm adjusted.
I'm a proud mother.
Yeah.
I see. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah,
for
that's helpful. And I guess because I don't have children, I was thinking, gee, I'm not really particularly interested in looking at her.
Yeah. Stop showing off. Yeah.
When you're when you have a new romantic interest and you go to that person's place, what should you look for? You talk about a bedroom test. What's a bedroom? I mean, we're talking about snooping here.
The other bedroom test. Okay. Well, it rather very much depends on your values. The thing that's really going to come out very strongly, we found in these places, in fact, looking in someone's bedroom is better than asking this person's close friends. Is their values? What they find important, and so on. So go and look at the art on the walls. Go look at the books. What's in them? What's in the music? And there will really tell you, for example, whether this person's sort of broad-minded or more concrete.
And there also can often be lots of pillows and dolls on the bed and all sorts of other things. I've been concerned when I've seen too many dolls on the bed of a grown woman.
You might develop your own hypothesis and then put it to the person and say, "What does this mean to you? Where does this come from? Why do you have this?"
Sharon from Warwick.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air.
I was just wondering if during your research you found that you could, you determined a certain characteristic by what you saw, but then upon further investigation you realized it showed you something completely different and were surprised by what you saw.
Yeah, absolutely, we found that. So, and this is one of the important ways that snooping is important, because it shows you where we systematically go wrong. So take the example of people's living spaces, for example. That's a place where we go into someone's living space and we see that it's clean and tidy and organized and so on. And so the impression that people get from that. So if you and I saw that when we went into somebody's space, we would think this person is organized, they're high on this conscientiousness factor. We would also think they were high on this agreeableness factor, the Mr. Rogers factor, think they're nicer. It turns out that only one of those is right. So the clues that are actually diagnostic of how organized and conscientious somebody is, we are using, it turns out, wrongly to also make inferences about how nice they are.
Okay, thank you. What does it reveal about someone who plays a lot of music as opposed to someone who plays no music? or keeps the news on all day. Well, keeps the news on is kind of obvious, but there are people who want to keep the house silent, and others who just need that sound, and whether it's compelling music that they really connect to, or just as background music. You're nodding your head, Daniel.
Some people really need people. It's almost like others are their drug, that they're, in a sense, arguably understimulated when they're left to themselves, and they need something going on, whether it's some person present or a voice coming over the radio, and that makes them feel, you know, complete, and without it, they may feel anxious.
Artists tell me that they listen to talk shows because their work can feel very solitary. Mm. That's the same sort of thing. Gene from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Just want to know, you know, every time you look at a president of the United States in the Oval Office, see all kind of pictures, and I don't know if you can learn anything about, you know, what kind of president they are, or it's all fake, and there's not really anything personal into this. I know there's always a picture of their wife and kids, which is obvious, but I don't know if there's anything we can learn about this.
You can pick up certain political orientations by looking at people's spaces. I think in the president's office, it's pretty highly controlled. What I would want to do if I was there is not look at these sort of obvious public places where they're going to be photographed, but take a look inside the drawers and in the sort of the more secret places.
Well, you say medicine cabinets can reveal a lot. I don't know whether anybody wants to go snooping through the president's medicine cabinet, but what do medicine cabinets tell you?
Well, there hasn't actually been any research on this, so this is where you need to look at. You need to use these general snooping principles. So you'd go in and look for consistencies. You'd go in, you'd look. You'd look, for example, how have they grabbed the toothpaste? Are they an impulsive? Do they just squeeze? Do they roll it up? Is it neat? Do they have? Do they have spare toothpaste? Do they think ahead, or are they the sort of person who runs out and then realizes they must do it? You'd look for the variety of things they have in there. Are there some obscure items there which would tell you something about their approach to novelty and so on.
Going back to the president's desk, it makes me think of one way in which snooping sometimes can go wrong, which is our spaces may be highly constrained, whether it's the president's desk in the Oval Office or our cubicles, and we don't really have much choice about how much or little to express about ourselves. But an onlooker could see that scene and attribute that or ascribe it to that individual. Make a misjudgment that the layout of the Oval Office is a reflection of this particular inhabitant, but it turns out that's just the layout of the Oval Office. So that's one kind of mistake we can make sometimes when we're snooping.
Carolyn from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm so glad that I got to listen to the previous callers because I was learning and being reinforced. Order is my drug, but I came from total chaos. Mm-hmm. And what I do for a living is I restore a family heirloom wedding gowns. And I'm doing it in my home. And when my bride comes and a mother, of course, comes, you know, everything is calm and organized. It's what I want to reflect. And there is art everything. I'm embraced by what it is I do, my dress forms, my art books. And as soon as I start to design, I bring out the laces or the ribbons or the beads. I'm like this little girl just throwing things around, and I'm somewhere else. It's like I'm not focused. I'm hyper-focused. And when they leave, we've created something marvelous. But I lay down in exhaust and say, oh, my God, look at the mess I made. This is my consistency. Order, chaos. Order, chaos. And wait, right now when I just finished after designing yesterday, and I just cleaned up my act, but I want to ask you about shame and basement consciousness, because I have a basement that is always pulling me in and, you know, throwing everything around and then having to go down there. And I feel like I have to get down there and organize it because I feel this shame. If, God forbid, something happened to me, my family went down there.
Yeah, it's like having dirty underwear when you have an accident. Basement consciousness, is this a scientific term? But you understand her point.
Sure.
So how do you respond to her?
Well, I think one of the interesting things here is that it shows that many of the places we try and create and the spaces we try and create do have their roots in our earlier experiences. I talk about this architecture firm, True Home, and Chris Travis, the guy who runs it, in my book. And what's really interesting about him is he designs homes on the basis of a really in-depth interview. And what he has found time and time again is how often we are trying to recreate something or react to something in our early childhood. You know, and indeed, I have an example in my book of my own experience of doing that, where I was trying to recreate my mother's, my grandmother's home in terms of the drinks cabinet.
One of the things I thought that was fun in the book was you had a listing of potential romantic interests, their musical tastes, mm-hmm. and they are quite different. Mm-hmm. You might choose to want to be with one at a party, yeah. another one for a long airplane ride.
Yeah.
So one might reveal that she's going to be a lot more fun in
outgoing,
some ways,
yeah.
and the other one, she'd be a lot more interesting to talk to.
Right, yes.
Or he, or right? I mean, it yeah. can go either way.
Right, yeah, exactly. And so, for example, one of the top tens in that collection had a lot of music from jazz and classical and blues and so on. And so we know that those people tend to be higher on this trait of openness, the Leonardo factor. They also tend to be less anxious, whereas the people who like this, the other collection, which had things like pop music, dance music, country music, and so on, those people tend to be outgoing and the wholesome people.
One person, we don't have time to take any more calls, but he wants to know what happens when two people live together with opposite tastes. You can go in that house and totally misread. Can't you?
You can. There are a number of different resolutions to that. So when I come across that, what I like to do is, even if they are conflicting or somebody has control over the whole place, is normally somebody has at least a little corner, whether it's the garage, the gardening shed, the sewing room, who knows what. There's a little corner. And so that is where you go and find out where this person has leaked out.
Sam Gosling will be giving a talk and signing books next Tuesday at 7 at the Borders Bookstore on 2nd Avenue and 32nd Street. His book, Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You, from Basic Books. Thank you so much for being with us, and thank you so much, Professor Daniel R. Ames of Columbia Business School. It's been a pleasure talking to you on today's Please Explain.
Thanks for having us.
On Monday's show, we'll hear the stories of two men who got caught up in the U.S. government's post-9/11 counterterrorism measures. Also, a new novel set at the turn of the century in the Florida Everglades, Ian Frazier's new collection of humorous essays, and the story of how Muqtada al-Sadr became the leader of Iraq's poor Shiites and the resistance to the occupation. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neeschick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. And we had help today from Judith Weber, Julia Corcoran, and John Cottrell. Leora Noam Kravitz was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.